You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, his attorney and author of the book Traitor, and the American Taliban, Jesselyn Radick, will be joining me to talk about the unprecedented war on whistleblowers. And, of course, that which upon they whistle blew. Whistleblown? Also on the program today, Nancy Pelosi fires the first shot of retreat by the Democrats on the issue of taxation. This lame duck session, folks. I don't know who's going to win the presidency. I have an idea. But this lame duck session, November and December, perhaps early January of 2012 and then 2013. Not a good time to be taking a vacation if you're someone like me. It's going to be pretty crazy, and we're seeing, I don't know what we're seeing actually with that. We'll dig into it, because this stuff, when you're talking about these type of deals, and we hear quite a bit about Taxamageddon, which, of course, is when all of the Bush tax cuts are set to expire. Simultaneously, the debt ceiling deal cuts are supposedly going to go into effect. It's going to have a real impact on the economy. The debt ceiling vote, the next one may come up sometime around January. Who knows? And essentially, people position themselves 6 to 8 months out on these things, which is why I want to make sure that you're aware of what's happening. Also on the program today, Piers Morgan. That Levinson inquiry that's taking place in Britain on the phone hacking scandals. I don't know that Piers Morgan is going to be terribly excited about testimony that was given yesterday, although one might imagine that he was anticipating it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jesselyn Radick and Thomas Drake, and we will be back in just a moment with that interview.
Hit me like a toll.
Okay, we are back. Sam Suter on the Majority Report. On the phone, we have the NSA whistleblower, Thomas Drake, and his attorney, Jesselyn Raddick, who is also the author of her just-released book, Traitor and the American Taliban. Thomas, Jesselyn, are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your patience as we had a little bit of technical difficulty. Jesselyn, let's start with you. I want to. You not only represented Thomas Drake in his case brought against him by the U.S. government for espionage, but you also were a whistleblower yourself. Tell us briefly your story.
Yes, I had been the Justice Department ethics attorney in the case of the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind. This was shortly after 9/11, and I had advised not to interrogate him without counsel and certainly not to torture him. And when the FBI did so anyway, I advised that that information would have to be sealed and not used for a criminal prosecution. Again, my advice was ignored. Evidence of that advice was withheld from the court. At that point, I blew the whistle, and the Lind case collapsed shortly thereafter. But for me, the journey had just begun because I was subject to all sorts of retaliation, including being put under criminal investigation myself, being referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney, and being put on the no-fly list. Because of that experience, that led me into representing whistleblowers because I knew what they were going through, and I didn't want anyone to have to go through what I went through. And eventually, working at the Government Accountability Project, that's all I do is represent whistleblowers, and I came to represent Thomas Drake when the government brought charges against him, the fourth person in U.S. history against whom the government has brought charges for espionage against a non-spy under the Espionage Act for allegedly mishandling classified information.
And while simultaneous to, or very close at least in time, as you were, and we should make it clear that your advice on the Lind case was solicited. I mean, they were holding John Walker Lind in Afghanistan, and your advice was solicited. They were perfectly aware that he had counsel at that time. You suggested that you told them that you cannot interrogate this man without that counsel, and they went ahead and did it, like you said, anyways, and then claimed after the fact that they weren't aware of that. Meanwhile, I guess across town, Thomas, you were working for the NSA. Tell us what your job was.
Well, I was hired in on a special outside hiring program. Kind of stir up the gene pool. There have been a lot of pressure put on NSA to bring in people from outside NSA, people that have not been brought up at NSA, were not promoted from within the system, particularly from Congress. So about a dozen of us were hired during the spring-summer of 2001. And so I answered an ad that was actually placed in the Washington Post. I was ultimately offered a position, and my first day on the job, and the title was Senior Change Leader. And I was reporting to the number three person, Maureen Baginski, who headed up the Signals Intelligence Directorate at the time. 9/11 was my first actual day on the job.
Wow. And at that time, you came to essentially to see that the NSA had material, had all sorts of data that, in your words, could have prevented 9/11. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, that was the first thing I discovered shortly after 9/11 is the sheer amount of information that NSA had, what they also knew about the information, but also later what they didn't know they had. It was very deep inside their data banks. And information that if it had gotten out and been shared with the rest of the government in the manner in which it was supposed to have been shared by NSA, I will say, could have easily have prevented, blunted the 9/11 attacks.
And
I was being given.
And why do you feel that that material never was shared? I mean, was there a statutory firewall or what was it?
No, they had standing regulations and provisions in which they were to share what's called actionable intelligence, indications and warning, information that when brought to the highest level of the government is the type of information you then take action on. They had that critical information in their databanks prior to 9/11. Now, I didn't discover this until after 9/11. There was people coming to me, and when I was later during one of the 9/11 congressional investigations trying to figure out what had gone wrong in the government in terms of preventing when the government was unable to prevent the attack, they started doing a lot of inquiries, and I was contacted as a material witness to provide critical information to a couple of different congressional investigations. During those investigations, I shared with them information that NSA had prior to 9/11 regarding al-Qaeda that had never been shared outside of NSA. In fact, they had prohibited the sharing of this critical information because, as I found out later, they didn't know what others would do with it. And so they decided to hold and retain it, to hoard the information rather than share the information.
And
kind of a pathological cultural condition.
And when you testified to those two committees, the House and Senate Permanent Select Committees on Intelligence, you were required by law, obviously, to testify to these committees.
Well, I was actually contacted by investigators, both the Sacksy-Shambliss subcommittee. It was a brand new committee that had been formed recently at that time under HPSI. I'd also been in contact prior to those investigations with other HPSI and CISI staffers. And then I was also called to material witness for the much larger investigation that precipitated in the spring and summer of 2002. And so I was a material witness. They had subpoena power. I was actually providing them significant amounts of information, some of it highly classified information, about what NSA knew, could have known, or should have known regarding the 9/11 perpetrators.
And how would you characterize the data that the NSA had at that time? And I believe this is under the program known as Trailblazer. Is that correct?
Well, Trailblazer never actually delivered anything. It's important to note that. That was a flagship program that was launched with great fanfare in the spring of 2000. It was supposed to bring NSA into the digital age. It failed abysmally, but it spent multiple billions of dollars attempting to do so for something that had already been solved by the very best of American ingenuity and innovation called FinThread, a program that had been developed with only a few millions of dollars by essentially a skunkworks team, a high-performing skunkworks team, who decided in the mid-90s to take on the great challenges of NSA, which one of them was a critical challenge: how do you make sense of data when you have so much information at hand? How do you make sense of all that? And so they took it on, they solved the core challenge problem, and they're ready to deploy FinThread on a worldwide basis well prior to 9/11, but NSA would not let them do that.
And how would you...
So Trailblazer was just a funding vehicle. That's all it was. It died an abysmal death in the 2005-2006 timeframe.
How would you characterize the information that NSA had at that time relative to its parameters as to what it was allowed to gather in terms of information on Americans?
Well, now you're in that's the other thing that I discovered. Shortly after 9/11, a critical decision was made with far-reaching implications. They opened up the Pandora's box. You have to remember there was lots of illegal surveillance by the American government during the 50s and 60s and 70s, culminating in the Nixon administration. And so they had the Frank Church and the Pike Committee hearings during that period in the 70s that ultimately led, which just uncovered a lot of the surveillance and illegal activity in monitoring Americans who were legitimately expressing their First Amendment rights and also violating their Fourth Amendment rights. So they formed the two standing intelligence committees to provide oversight of the secret side of government. They also put into law during the Carter administration in 1978 a statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was the exclusive means by which the U.S. government could conduct surveillance with a warrant, although there were hot pursuit options. They'd still have to go back at the warrant later in a rather short period of time, but could not conduct electronic surveillance on any basis without a warrant issued by that court. That was modified five times prior to 9/11. After 9/11, they chose to completely bypass that statute, and they entered into a very, very secret program in which NSA became the executive agent, a program now known, I knew it then, but it's become out in public, called Stellar Wind, which was became a vast dragnet electronic surveillance program across the United States domestically.
So, Jesselyn, when Thomas goes and reports to the various entities, whether it was Senate or House committees or to the DOD Inspector General, to essentially whistleblow, outline for us what actions he took that should have been covered under U.S. law and protection for whistleblowers.
That acts that are lawfully covered are certainly reporting to his superiors, reporting to the inspector generals are protected by the Inspector General Act of 1978, and reporting to Congress is protected by the Intelligence Community's Whistleblower Protection Act as well as the First Amendment. He reported to all of the proper internal channels, and I've never seen a whistleblower who so appropriately and properly reported through the official channels, yet all of them failed him.
And so all of those whistleblower channels failed him, and ultimately, was it that reporting that became the basis for the government's attempt to prosecute Thomas under the Espionage Act?
Yes, totally inappropriately. The government used protected disclosures that Mr. Drake had made to the Department of Defense Inspector General as the basis for the Espionage Act counts against him. So in a way, he was completely double-crossed by the office and agency that was supposed to protect him. Now, that office and agency actually did a long report over 2.5 years, which found in favor of Drake and the other whistleblowers. There were four other whistleblowers. Yet they classified that report immediately, so it was not available to the public. And meanwhile, when the Justice Department decided to start a so-called leak investigations for how its secret domestic warrantless wiretapping program, which was illegal, how that got out, the Defense Department Inspector General apparently turned over the names of Tom and the other people who had lawfully complained.
Now, and Jesselyn, your experience versus Thomas's in terms of, I want to get a sense of. How different members of Congress reacted. I know that in your case, Jesselyn, when you were being essentially prosecuted or at the very least persecuted by the Department of Justice in some respects for blowing the whistle on the fact that John Lynn Walker had an attorney, that the Department of Justice was aware that he had an attorney, and they ignored that, and therefore essentially tainted any evidence, in addition to the way that they treated him, tainted any evidence for use in a criminal trial. My understanding is, according to your book, Traitor and the Whistleblower, the Whistleblower and the American Taliban, that the late Senator Kennedy at least intervened in some respect on your behalf. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was very grateful for that because as a Washington, D.C. resident, I don't have a voting member in Congress. So I was very fortunate that he intervened. But in Tom's case, it was radio silence. Congress at the highest levels was fully aware of Tom Drake's predicament, and nobody intervened, which is very cowardly and unfortunate. Basically, Congress is supposed to do oversight over these agencies, and here, not only were they not overseeing the agency, they weren't overseeing the agency when it was acting completely ultra-virus and outside the scope of what it was allowed to do in terms of harassing somebody.
Thomas, I mean, tell me about that part of your journey here. I mean, at different points, you are reaching out to different authorities, whether it is or in fact not even reaching out, being called in to talk to different authorities and to provide them information that they're seeking. In some instances, you're talking to committee chairs, you're talking to committee staffers. In other instances, you're talking to your immediate superior at the NSA, who essentially, and my understanding is that you're the director of signals intelligence, who was the number three person at NSA, who you worked for, Maureen Baginski. Instead of helping you in providing this information that was your responsibility to provide for her, she was upset that you had provided her this information, correct?
Well, there's any number of incidents. There's the one in which I actually provided her this very long-range study about al-Qaeda and associated movements that had never been released to the rest of the government but had been finished well prior to 9/11. I actually brought it to her attention when it was brought to my attention by very concerned analysts not long after 9/11, and she actually looked at me and said, "I wish you had never brought this to my attention." She needed plausible deniability. In early 2002, she actually pulled me inside and warned me in no uncertain terms that they were looking for leakers, not leakers to the press, you know, not leakers to people that are unauthorized to receive any government information or classified information, but leakers to the congressional investigators looking into what NSA knew, could have known, or should have known prior to 9/11. So, you know, the message was very clear. When I was then contacted in early 2003 by the Department of Defense Inspector General auditors investigators regarding Trailblazer and ThinThread, I remember telling him right up front I was extraordinarily concerned about retaliation and reprisal by virtue of having contact with them. And they said, "Well, if you're reprised against by NSA, you know, you can actually submit a reprisal complaint and we will investigate it, because you cannot be reprised for cooperating, because they have the speed of power too, with an official investigation that actually went on for well over almost 2.5 years for that particular investigation." So, yes, I was fully compromised. The irony of my case, the central charges that the government issued, when I was indicted in April of 2010, there were 10 counts. There was 5 counts under the Espionage Act, but the centerpiece of their charges, the details of which remain sealed, but I can share this with you, were in whole or in part, the actual documents that they alleged that I retained for the purposes of disclosure, which is not even in the law, by the way, those particular documents, in whole or in part, were provided to the Department of Defense Inspector General investigators. So, and I had been asked to retain anything I could. Of course, I wasn't going to retain anything classified. I did retain a fair amount of unclassified material, and the reason was in case they ever needed to have to do follow-up or there's additional questions for the record, I would at least have some way to be able to recreate some of what I had provided to them as part of protected communications. So isn't it ironic that the very basis of their case, okay, in terms of the Espionage Act charges, was centered on information that I actually provided to them as protected communication as part of an official government investigation.
Right, and had you withheld those documents from them? I mean, so these documents were required to give them these documents, and then the fact that – and they told you to hold on to them, and then the fact that you hold on to them became the basis of their charges against you.
Yes, that is correct. And that, the reason – yes, yes.
And we should also, I just want to put a fine point on this.
By the way, those documents were never shared. It's important to note for your listening audience, those documents were never shared with anybody except the investigators, period. None.
So essentially, the charges amounted to charging you for providing them to government investigators.
Yes.
And I want to.
Yes. Although what they have, I did have contact with a reporter later. I was so, because I'll remember it, just said a short time ago, all of my whistleblowing, both internal to NSA and outside of NSA within proper government channels, protected communication channels, all came to naught. So when the 2005 Blockbuster article came out, written by Risen and Wickbauer, we're doing for the first time at least one portion of this much larger Dragnet surveillance program, which was illegal to begin with, which the government can be labeled the terror surveillance program. When that story hit, I knew that there was others that knew, but I also knew that there was far more to the story and that there was a much, much larger program. And I also knew, because I had made that case internally after 9/11 and to the investigators, there was a legal alternative, would have provided superior intelligence and would have provided all the protections to Americans under the Fourth Amendment, and was fully compliant with FISA.
All right, so
it was never necessary to go to the dark side.
So, Jesselyn, we've heard the characterization of essentially testifying to Congress as leaking within the context of the NSA. I want to ask you, in your experience at the Department of Justice, was there a similar perspective, I guess? Was there a similar culture of that if you were to testify in proper channels, if you were to cooperate with investigators within proper channels, did the DOJ have the same sort of, I guess, culture which perceived that as leaking? Because, of course, that's not leaking by any stretch of the manner. But if you characterize it as leaking, it presupposes that what you're doing is wrong. Did the Department of Justice have a similar culture, do you think?
Yes, it had at the time set up an anti-leak task force shortly after 9/11. And it had an inspector general, again, whom you could lawfully go to with complaints and supposedly be protected. I did go to the inspector general of my agency and also ended up being retaliated against in spades. The difference between my case and Tom's is that for me, the retaliation entailed being placed under criminal investigation, referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed, and being put on the no-fly list. Bush treated whistleblowers unmercifully, but Obama took it to a whole new level by criminally prosecuting them.
And I definitely want to get to that part of it, but I want to ask you both, and let's start with you, Jesselyn. What is it about these agencies that ostensibly are designed to protect Americans, that are the Department of Justice? I mean, it's called the Department of Justice. What is it about these agencies that perceive this type of cooperation, of actually working within the context of the system, and certainly in Thomas's case would have provided far more efficiency and legality, it sounds like, in our intelligence gathering? What is it about these agencies that end up looking upon that normal functioning as being criminal?
You know, I think it's a very warped bureaucratic response. Often the target of the inspector general becomes not the person against whom the complaint was lodged, but the person who made the complaint, him or herself. And I think it's this defensive agency reaction. They say they're open to hearing dissent, and criticism, particularly about fraud, waste, abuse, and illegality. But then when people actually do that, they are treated as the problem. Now, I think that happens in big bureaucracies in the government. I think it happens at large corporations. But I think there's very much a groupthink mentality to go along and get along and not to rock the boat, or else you, if you didn't have that bureaucratic mentality, as I call it, you probably wouldn't be working at a place like the Justice Department or Enron. But certainly setting up these sham systems that are meant to protect whistleblowers internally end up functioning as basic entrapment when people trust that by going there, those offices are actually going to do something.
Thomas, particularly, I would think like the only circuit breaker here is theoretically is those members of Congress who are theoretically not within the context of those bureaucracies and ostensibly are supposed to be providing oversight for those bureaucracies. What do you think? Why do you think there was such cowardice on the part of all those staffers, all those Congress people, all those senators who were aware of your testimony, who required your testimony when it came time to actually defend you for providing that information? They didn't. What do you think what was motivating them?
They made a political calculus that it was better to fold with the national security state and those that were in charge of it and give them the benefit of the doubt than to actually pursue the very troubling information that I was bringing to their attention, and particularly the information regarding the massive fraud, waste, and abuse and the illegalities. I gave it to them on a silver platter. It was laid out in great detail, time, place, and circumstance.
And where
and
is
so
that?
In the end, they.
Where is that information now? Who has that information? I mean, is there anybody? Go ahead.
All those details were given to the investigators, all of them. I mean, reams of information. We're talking, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of pages of prima facie evidence.
And
but NSA was largely let off the hook. Interestingly enough, a lot of attention was given to the CIA and the FBI and other parts of the government. But NSA's culpability in 9/11, and never mind, they kind of doubled down after 9/11. As I was told, informed internally, 9/11 by the, this is the highest levels of NSA, was a gift to NSA. That 9/11 now would give NSA all the money that it ever wanted or wished for, and that certainly happened.
Right now, or just this week, the extension for the FISA law has passed through committee. We still have two senators, Mark Udall and Ron Wyden, who have said as much as they can, have raised a red flag that the government is interpreting the FISA law in a way that I think in their words, I'm paraphrasing, the American public would be very surprised and dismayed to find out how they're interpreting it. Give me your sense, to the extent that you can say anything on this. What do you think they're talking about?
They're talking about a secret interpretation that we still don't know what the exact wording is regarding Section 215, legislation was passed by Congress and signed into law. The secret interpretation, it's very clear what it is. It's extraordinarily expansive. They essentially have carte blanche requests to go to any businesses and gain the subscriber information, period, on a vast scale. That's the secret interpretation in a nutshell. Have I ever seen it? No. Has anybody else? Apparently, no, because it's apparently one of the most closely guarded secrets in the government, the secret interpretation.
Who would generate that secret interpretation?
We're talking about the executive branch itself.
And so this is something that would come
consider it a secret signing statement. In essence, where the president essentially says, well, yes, I am signing this legislation into law, per the Constitution. However, I'm going to grant myself the ability to reinterpret it as I see fit. And, we've had many cases, especially in recent history, where presidents will sign signing statements to that effect. This is the equivalent of a secret version of that.
And so
it's enabling those instruments of power, surveillance power, and collection power within the U.S. government to essentially have carte blanche access or in agreements, in secret agreements with businesses, or they go to the businesses to hand over that information. Meanwhile, they're, you know, they're in, on the open side of this, not the secret side, but the open side. They continue to push for legislation that essentially legalizes what they're doing illegally.
And as far as you can tell, with at least a better awareness of these issues than people who have not been exposed to what you've been exposed to, is there anybody out there who is fighting against the sort of essentially making legal what has since been illegal?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that when they're trying to make illegal what is supposedly illegal, that's often a sign that they are already doing it, as we've learned from history. But there are groups like the ACLU and like the Government Accountability Project and EPIC and EFF and DCT, a number of surveillance groups who are into openness and transparency and care about privacy rights, who are trying to make this public and trying to get to the heart of what is going on here. Unfortunately, those groups are not typically very representative of what most Americans are feeling. I think most people are not nearly as worried enough about this as they should be. And so you have these groups trying to do what they can and working very valiantly to do so, but it's falling on deaf ears. As you said, one piece of legislation that's problematic already has been approved by the Senate, and you know it looks like it's going to go ahead and sail on through to extend the FISA Amendments Act. Not only to extend it beyond expiration, but to expand it.
Jesselyn, the espionage case against Thomas fell apart in June of last year. Why did it fall apart, and why do you think it was brought in the first place?
I think it was brought in the first place because the administration thought that it could send a strong message to intelligence community and national security whistleblowers to shut up. It fell apart because it was based on sand. I mean, they had alleged, the FISA Espionage Council alleged that Tom had improperly retained, allegedly classified information when, in point of fact, none of that information turned out to be classified after all, and it collapsed. The case collapsed in spectacular fashion. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have deterred the Justice Department to continue its ill-advised campaign of bringing such cases in an attempt to chill not only whistleblowers but journalists.
Well, yeah, I want to get to the journalist part here, but I mean, it's clear that in bringing these cases, maybe the intent is not necessarily is not as much about, carrying out justice, but as much as intimidating others within the government from providing this type of information. Thomas, what other forms of intimidation and reprisals have you been subjected to?
Well, you got a couple hours. I mean, it started after 9/11 when it became clear that I was cooperating with, two 9/11. Well, originally the first 9/11 congressional investigation, it was made very clear to me that I was not to cooperate. They were waving me off. They did not want me to talk about what I knew from inside NSA. That in itself an extraordinarily chilling message. And then they began to do everything they could to pick apart the team that I led, and to put me in and isolate me into a box, take away responsibilities. And then when I was involved in the DODIG investigation, they ultimately reorganized the entire office in which I was a part of. And I ended up with a know-nothing job. So the message was very, very clear.
And
never mind the message that was being sent to all the people that I work with, because I'd been singled out.
And
of course, the ultimate form of that was when they actually prosecuted me. You believe me, by virtue of prosecuting me and then so publicly indicting me a couple of years ago, that really sent the message. I've talked to people privately who still work within government. They said, well, you know, if they went after you like that, the last thing I'm going to do is say anything to anybody about anything. I'm just going to keep my head down. You know, I don't want to jeopardize my retirement. I don't want to jeopardize my mortgage. I got kids in college. But they saw what happened to me and others.
And you had worked for the CIA before this. Is that correct?
Yes, I had.
And so,
yeah, plus I had also been in the military, both Air Force and Navy.
And now you are without any type of pension.
No.
And I imagine it has severely curtailed this whole public, essentially making an example of you. I imagine has curtailed your opportunities now, even in the private sector.
Yes, because I'm considered damaged goods, radioactive, and by virtue of what's happened to me, and because I'm more than just a passing footnote in history, it would be extraordinarily challenging for me to seek employment either in areas in which I used to work. Obviously, my clearance was taken away. It's important to note for listening audience, part of all of this is simply to destroy the whistleblower's life. And they went to great lengths to do that. I mean, I don't think people fully appreciate how much the individual whistleblower, actually suffers as a result of the government putting everything they've got. And they have quite an arsenal, okay, especially when they're doing it for other reasons and not for justice, when they come after somebody in such an egregious manner as they did with me. I've got lots of debt. I had to take out a second mortgage. You know, I'd spent upwards of $100,000 for a private attorney. I ended up qualifying as indigent before the federal court, which meant I now could only be represented by federal public defenders. That's just skimming the surface.
And Jesselyn, of course, the government basically got you fired from your first job outside of the government and continues to this day to attempt to get you disbarred. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I also racked up about $100,000 in legal bills trying to fend off these attacks by the government. And while you're trying to spend all this money for lawyers to defend yourself, at the same time, you're not bringing in any kind of income stream. So it's a real double whammy on people financially to go through this. And that sends another message about why you should not even think about disclosing wrongdoing by your government.
Now, the Obama...
Very dangerous in today's...
I'm sorry, go ahead,
Very dangerous in today's... Yeah, very dangerous in today's U.S. to be a whistleblower and right when the government is so wrong.
It's a
corrupt system. You know, it's really injustice. It's not justice by any means. I mean, what you're really facing here, we've got to get right down to brass tacks. You have this expansion, the burgeoning expansion of a national security state. National security has become the new state religion. It is sacrosanct. You do not question it. You do not violate it. And any oath you may have taken, I say oath, okay, to the Constitution, it doesn't matter. The agreements you sign with that national security state, they'll want a promise. It's essentially a loyalty oath. So you're just to shut up, do your job, follow orders, and don't worry about what you see that takes place in front of you. And yet I had an obligation, you know, under the Constitution to support and defend it and to faithfully execute the law of the land. I could not sit back and say nothing. The reason, if I did, I would have been complicit in the subversion of our own Constitution.
And Jesselyn, we have seen, and you mentioned this, an unprecedented use of the Espionage Act and an unprecedented attack on whistleblowers by the Obama administration. Why do you think they're even going further than the Bush administration did?
I think... Initially, I thought it was so Obama could curry favor with the national security and intelligence establishments, which saw him as weak coming into office. It became pretty obvious as these cases proceeded that it was to create that precedent for going after journalists. And I think in the grand scheme of things, it's a backdoor way of creating an official Secrets Act, which we don't have in this country.
As opposed to Britain. So tell me, how is it that it would set precedents for going after journalists?
Well, right now we're already seeing, in, for example, the case of Jeffrey Sterling, another CIA whistleblower who's being prosecuted. Jim Risen of the New York Times is being asked to testify against his source. So far, the lower court has ruled that there is a reporter's privilege not to have to testify against your source, and that is on appeal before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most conservative court in the country. And no matter what the ruling is coming out of the Fourth Circuit, I think it may go up to the Supreme Court. And that is a huge question. 31 states have reporter reportorial shield laws, reporter shield laws, but there's no federal reporter shield law. And you can see with all of these cases, every single one of them involves a leak, a supposed leak to a media news outlet. And journalists are sprinkled throughout the indictments of these men. So I think it's very much about going after the media. And I think the media is starting to realize, like, yeah, this can have implications for us, too. You know, Jim Risen could be held in contempt of court for refusing to testify against a source if the court rules he has to do that. And his choice at that point would be to go to jail or reveal his confidential source.
That's really the threat here. I was the test case, and I knew that when it happened. I also knew, though, if I only relied on the criminal side of our justice system to defend me, that would be insufficient. I have to find a way to influence the court of public opinion. That's why, ultimately, the mainstream media, but in particular the alternative media, became so crucial in getting the word out about what was really going on. I will tell you that I've had off-the-record conversations with reporters and journalists. They said by virtue of my case alone and all the subsequent cases that have been brought against whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, that it's already sent a message. And then in many respects, journalist reporters who've enjoyed, quote-unquote, off-the-record access to, you know, some key government officials, and in some cases long-standing, they're increasingly reluctant to say anything even off the record. So the chilling effect is already happening. And that's now that becomes a form of censorship, kind of pretextual censorship. That's not what this country's all about.
Do you think that there is an increased fear within the context of the security state apparatus of things like entities like, not specifically, but maybe specifically, but entities like WikiLeaks, that the changes in technology that both allow agencies like the NSA to abuse and to break the laws and to abuse the rights of individuals in this country, at the same time they perceive a greater threat because of technology that has in some way inspired this attack on journalists, because it seems to me that the you go for the higher hanging fruit when you're talking about the New York Times. It becomes that much easier to prevent any type of entities like a WikiLeaks, say. Jesslyn, what's your thoughts on that?
I think WikiLeaks has complicated this whole thing because it was such a massive disclosure that occurred during kind of the middle of these prosecutions being brought. But I think it's disingenuous of the administration to say, well, this is really about WikiLeaks, because if the administration gave a damn about people going to WikiLeaks, then the easiest solution would be to pass meaningful, effective whistleblower protection reform.
So they wouldn't necessarily have to go outside of the government if they could get the genuine protection within the context of the government.
Yes, exactly. Meaningful, effective, and enforceable whistleblower protection. We have a whistleblower protection enhancement act right now that has been passed through the Senate through unanimous consent, but we'll see what happens to it. It's been pending for 12 years now. We've been going through the same song and dance, so I'd be curious to see if it gets through.
Do either one of you have
a
cent? Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, become a whistleblower, become a target. I'll just tell you that. This is one of the problems. I mean, I knew that many, many years ago, that by virtue, even when I was called subpoenaed, and then even when I was part of the DOD, I was again subpoenaed as a mature witness, I became a target.
And do you think that there is any type of statutory protection that could change that culture and that sense that whistleblowers are going to become such a target?
Yeah, as long as it's enforceable, but you're gonna have to have, you know, it has to be enforceable. It just can't be on paper. It has to be meaningful protection. You have to be able to have access to the courts and due process. It can't be a case where you're left out on your own, and if they decide to compromise you, like they did in my case, by turning over my name and my colleagues' names to the Department of Justice for prosecution, I mean, that's a complete compromise of the very means by which you're supposed to have a protected channel to report wrongdoing and illegalities and threats to public safety and health.
Jesselyn, I can't help but think, like, where are the senators? Where are the Congress people? I mean, they are theoretically outside of that bureaucratic system, and they are the ones who are supposed to be offering checks. They're the ones who are sitting on the oversight committees. And without some measure of, I mean, I don't even know if it requires a certain amount of bravery, I guess, on their part. But they seem to me to be the best positioned players in all of this to make sure that these whistleblower statutes and these internal investigations are kept legitimate.
Well, you are correct. They are in the best position for that. But unfortunately, a lot of them are compromised. For example, Lisa Monaco testified to the National Security Division of Justice that the war on leaks was being egged on by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which certainly has its own interests and complicity and involvement in the warrantless wiretapping program at issue. I think the reason Congress has not been doing anything is because of their own liability. So yes, the people who are in the best position to actually have oversight and have enforcement and find out why this is happening are too compromised to do so.
Well, Thomas Drake, Jesselyn Raddick, the book is Traitor and the American Taliban. We'll put a link to that up at majority.fm. If there's anything else you think we should link to or where people can get more information, we'll link to the Human Rights, the Government Accountability Project, which covers the keeping the government accountable, particularly on this issue of whistleblowing. We will do so. But I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having
me. Important topic.
All right. We're going to take a break, folks, and we will be back in just a moment. I guess we're going to head into the better half of the program today, although that's going to be tough to beat.
That was really good. I really enjoyed that.
Folks, again, you know, I don't know how to give you a better example of, you know, what we're trying to do here. And your support for this program is the only thing that can keep it going. And
if we don't get members after that, I mean, come on now. That was just unbelievable.
Well, we hope that you'll support the program so we can continue to do stories like this. And also, you know, so that I can go into the next half of the show and talk about my eczema. You can become a member by going to majority.fm, clicking on the membership, choosing a membership option. There are other ways to support the show you can find at majority.fm/support the show, some of which cost you absolutely zero, some of which barely take more than 10 or 15 seconds. Any way you do it, we appreciate your support. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter and Dave Hill, who also has a new book entitled Tasteful Nudes. Yes. All right, folks, see you in the better half. You can call this program at 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. I will take your IMs and your calls right after this. Coming up in the better half, more on this, these rumblings. Well, Nancy Pelosi's not even rumbling, has come out sort of, I guess, actually to the right of President Obama on this question of taxation. Also, Piers Morgan, is he the next guy in hot water? I guess I should get my should bone up on like America's Got Talent or whatever it is so that I can well position myself for that 9 p.m. CNN slot. Are they still interviewing Joan Collins? Is she still alive? I don't know. All right, folks, see you in the better half.